Number 12-6417, Bariano v. United States.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The government has conceded all of the elements of coram nobis here except the one that brings us here today. That is whether or not the Court can conclude, reviewing this de novo beyond a reasonable doubt, whether the introduction of honest services material and honest services jury instruction in this case contributed towards the guilty verdict. Based upon the record below, it is quite clear that it could not. In this particular case, the government made a very different argument during closing argument in the trial some 18 years ago. At that time, the government, in fact, recognized that its pecuniary fraud arguments and claims were the weakest of the indictment and that the honest services part was its strongest. During closing argument, the government told the jury that, quote, the honest services aspect of this case is really not in debate, that it was not a close call, essentially. And then it recognized what Judge Nickerson also recognized when he called the pecuniary fraud the more tenuous, the closer call, the one that was in a cloud of smoke. The government told the jury at that time that the real debate, what was really in contest, was the pecuniary fraud. And indeed, this court must analyze, as the case law we cited shows, whether or not how weak the government's remaining case is with respect to pecuniary fraud. And I suggest to the court that it is an extremely weak case. First of all, in terms of the pecuniary fraud, it occupied very little of the overall trial.
Were you a trial attorney?
I was not. I was.
Judge Nickerson was the trial judge.
He was. He was. That was some 18 years ago.
Yes.
And Judge Nickerson, in his opinion below,
in the legislature then?
I was in the legislature, and I had a little more hair then. That was my last year in the legislature.
Yeah, I still remember that all. Let me just ask you from the get-go, how could there have been an honest services claim without the pecuniary fraud? In other words, what dishonest service was there other than the fraud?
Well, most of it was dishonest services. What the government claimed,
but it all stems from the pecuniary fraud. That's the only thing that was done.
Not necessarily, because
okay, tell me what else.
I'll give you six or seven items in the record.
Okay.
First of all, the government claimed that all of these things predated the money coming into the hands of the Bariano firm. All of the following, what I'm about to tell you,
okay.
The false filing allegedly of a lobbying registration report. The false filing of legislative expense reports, the false filing of campaign expense reports, the false filing allegedly of how the of the lobbying registration in the first place. All of that, those events predated any of the money coming into the Bariano firm.
But maybe I'm wrong, but I thought that the dishonest services all went back to getting this money. That's not true.
Now, we
understand we're going to hear from the United States.
I understand.
Here. So it's up to you to kind of make your case here.
The government claimed at trial that when they asked rhetorically and repeatedly.
Let's talk about the indictment for starters.
Well, the indictment for starters listed both a violation of honest services and faithful services, and then later on mentioned, and also the loss of money and property. That's the way it was framed in the indictment. At the trial, what the government claimed was that Mr. Bariano had made nominee contributions through employees. They broke it down actually into three parts, part one, part two, and part three. Part one and part two had nothing to do with getting money from the clients, and the government ceded that. Part one and part two involved making nominee contributions, loans to or giving money to staff members making conduit contributions, and then these not being accurately reported.
Let me just try one more time, just to be sure I understand your argument. I understand the government asserted all these things, but it was my understanding, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that they didn't claim there would have been any honor services for fraud unless there had been the pecuniary fraud, unless money had been received for these purposes. You could have had all these other things.
Actually, no. The
okay.
government asked for a jury instruction which used the word or. And in that
the jury instruction, to be sure, was wrong.
But,
and they pursued both theories.
But the government...
And they spent a long time on the theory that the Supreme Court has disavowed, to be sure. But you could never have had any claim for that fraud if you hadn't had the exchange of the money.
Well, that's not necessarily true.
Well, is it true?
It's possible that Mr. Barriano could have received, in this case, Mr. Barriano could have received money without fraudulent intent, but then used it in, quote, a breach of fiduciary duty, which was the government's theme.
There's no claim for that in this case.
Actually, there is in the indictment, and there is throughout the trial.
Okay.
What the government argued and put on six public officials, put on the State Ethics Commission director, put on numerous staff members to basically argue that the heart of the case was the honest services. It was basically federalizing a state election law violation. They were basically saying Mr. Barriano made loans to his various staff members, that they made contributions, and that those contributions were antithetical to his client's interests, that he, and they used the words in the instructions and closing argument, they concealed that information from the clients, they did not tell the clients that these loans had been made, the clients had supported other political candidates, when the clients, this was basically putting Mr. Barriano's interests ahead of the client's interests. All of this conduct predated Mr. Barriano, the allegation that this was reimbursed. And I would, by Mr. Barriano later on in what was called legislative expenses. Now, I would argue, Your Honors, the real question here is not whether the case could stand alone. And the Third Circuit in Martinez said this frequently happens in coram nobis cases, where the courts look at a sufficiency of the evidence analysis and they conflate that when the real test here has to be what was the impact of all of this admissible evidence and all of this argument and the incorrect jury instruction upon the jury, upon the overall trial. The test here is not whether there was still legally sufficient evidence to convict. The test is not whether or not the case would still be here. The test is whether or not this jury, here, not having the honest services instruction, not having the honest services witnesses, not having the honest services argument, would still have convicted Mr. Barriano. And can this court conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that all of that inadmissible evidence, that all of those instructions did not contribute toward the jury's verdict?
That sounds like a spillover argument.
It is, essentially. It is essentially a spillover here. Although it's sort of a reverse spillover, because the government's main case here, their main argument, their strongest argument, was the honest services and not the pecuniary fraud. And what the case law says is that in making this analysis, this court has to analyze the weakness of the pecuniary fraud case from the jury's eyes. Not a legal sufficiency issue, but how weak was the case to the jury. This was extraordinarily weak. It was, as Judge Nickerson said, tenuous, a cloud of smoke, a very close case. Why? Because
to what extent do we give deference to Judge Nickerson's views as expressed in his opinion of what happened at the trial, since he's the trial judge?
Well, I think
we give any deference at all. Like, is there clear error review on anything?
Well, you're
everything de novo. What do you?
You're viewing all this de novo, essentially.
It's all de novo. So the fact that he tried the case doesn't make any difference.
Well, the fact is
he sat there and listened to it all and knew exactly what went on. Doesn't make any difference.
Well, no, I think it does make a difference. Because
we're not giving complete de novo, then we're doing something else, aren't we?
Well, there's some facts here which are actually very interesting. When it came time,
it may be interesting, but maybe you could answer his question.
We
reviewed de novo.
You reviewed.
We give deference to the district judges.
You reviewed de novo, but clearly that contributes to the atmosphere of when the neutral trial judge makes these observations about the evidence. I think it can serve as a.
You're arguing about what the government emphasized, and they're arguing about what they emphasized, and all that. And there's a cold record for us to look at to try to figure out what they emphasized. But then the judge, district judge, who's the trial judge, who sat there and did it all, he gives some views on that. Do we give any deference to what he says? Or do we just disregard what he says?
I don't think you give deference to it, but I think it can be a guide to de novo review, essentially.
Okay.
And there are two other aspects of what Judge Nickerson did.
It's kind of unique. I mean, I would have to agree with that.
It is. And with respect to the issue of what was the amount of the loss, this was prior to Booker and Fanfan, and at that time, Judge Nickerson basically decided here that of the $16,000 the government claimed, they hadn't proved any except for $600, the $3,150. He threw out $150, thank you. He threw out all the other 93% and declined to order restitution because he found...
Some kind of a de minimis argument?
There was a de minimis argument that could be made at trial.
Is there a de minimis issue here or anything?
I think the issue here is whether it's a weakness argument. And what the case law says is...
The fact that the amount of money is kind of small goes to that, you think?
Exactly. The amount... We were not going to have a 12-day federal trial over $150 from four clients. And by the way, these were four clients who stood up and said, we weren't defrauded.
Why is that relevant? It boggles my mind to think about why that matters. $600, $600,000, if they were defrauded, that's the end of the inquiry.
Here's why it matters. The issue here, and certainly people can be defrauded without feeling they were defrauded, and that's not required for a legally sufficient conviction, but the issue here is the impact upon the jury. The test that this panel must use is, what's the impact of all that upon the weakness of the pecuniary fraud case? And there's a whole lot of difference between a widow who shows up and has had her life savings wiped out by someone who committed mail fraud upon her and four very sophisticated clients who show up and say, we are the ones that drafted this retainer agreement that had legislative expenses, and maybe it showed up in the wrong column, or maybe it wasn't this, but we certainly don't feel defrauded here.
That may be an issue with respect to prosecutorial discretion as to whether or not to bring the charge, and perhaps an issue in sentencing, but I still don't understand if the evidence is legally sufficient, that's the end of the inquiry, regardless of the amount of money involved.
No, because the inquiry for this panel, reviewing de novo the case, is whether or not the honest services, the mistaken instruction, contributed towards the jury's finding.
And all of this argument goes to your claim that the actual pecuniary fraud charges were very weak.
Very weak.
Okay. I still don't see how that helps you at all, because weak as they were, the jury found that there was this pecuniary fraud.
Actually, they didn't. They found that there was mail fraud that had pecuniary fraud and honest services lumped in a general verdict. Had there been an itemized verdict, they may well have, and I would argue would likely have found, that there was honest services and not pecuniary fraud. And then there would have been a lot of post-trial litigation.
Those prongs would have satisfied the elements of the offense, or satisfied the crucial element of the offense that you're getting to.
Correct.
Do you think we would have to decide your favor that the error was harmful?
Well,
beyond a reasonable doubt, or that it was harmless beyond a reason.
Harmless. I think that
harmless provide for the government. We'd have to find that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
The government's burden here.
How you turn that around for your own benefit?
It's not the government's burden. It's your burden.
Well, we're the appellant here. We're the appellant here. But there must be.
I know that. But you are the one that wants the extraordinary relief.
But it must be found here. The panel must conclude that in making its decision that there was error that did not contribute beyond a reasonable doubt to what the jury did.
There's error. Everybody concedes there's error. And is it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes.
That's the issue we face.
This panel must.
In our view.
In your view.
Based on this entire record.
Yes.
Is it harmless beyond a reasonable
right.
doubt? And if it doesn't pass muster on that, you win.
That's correct.
Now, was this decided post-Skilling, of course. Was it decided pre-Jefferson?
It was, I believe.
Does Jefferson help you or hurt you?
I don't think it really has much impact here.
It doesn't make any difference.
No. I think the basic problem that the trial court missed here below in terms of deciding this is the court looked at sufficiency of the evidence. What this panel has to do is strip away all the honest services evidence, the six public officials that testified, the executive director of the Ethics Commission that testified, all the information from the State Lobbying Commission, all the information about the false reports to the Ethics Commission, all the information from the employees that had nothing to do with this but nominee contributions, to strip all that out for the trial, and then if the panel can conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that there still would have been a conviction, that those did not contribute towards the guilty finding, then the government wins. But I think that is defies common sense to take a trial in which the predominant theme in this trial was honest services, that the transcript was consumed with honest services evidence, that we have public officials come in and saying they were triggered to make false reports on this, that we have the State Ethics Commission director coming in and testifying for 48 pages, that we have 106 pages from public officials saying we filed false reports because of this, and then to say that didn't have any impact on the jury. This was the explosive testimony before the jury. This is what gave the government's case sex appeal. On the pecuniary fraud, there was virtually no direct testimony except for Mr. O'Hearn, who denied that Mr. Biriano had a role in this, and then that's why this was caught, and she was then impeached with grand jury testimony. That's why Judge Nickerson found this case so tenuous, so weak, a cloud of smoke, because there was very little on the pecuniary side of this case in terms of the evidence. In this particular case, the pecuniary fraud consisted of an impeachment by Ms. O'Hearn of grand jury testimony, two initials on two checks, and a whole bunch of spreadsheets, and that really was it. The balance of the case, if you were to follow this transcript, had nothing to do with pecuniary fraud. This was an honest services case. The government had it right when it told the jury, basically, as in closing argument, that this is not a close case about honest services, that, and if honest services still existed, that's what they would say, but that this was a real debate. The government itself characterized below the pecuniary fraud as a real debate. What was the pecuniary fraud case in here? A case of $16,000 that was claimed, that was whittled down to $600, $150 each. Four individual, very sophisticated clients who came in and said that they weren't defrauded, and an employee who came in and said Mr. Biriano had no role in these reimbursements. If it happened, it didn't happen because of Mr. Biriano.
I think your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
A long, full day.
Thank you, Your Honor, very much.
May it please the Court. Judge Motz, I'd like to start by answering the question you asked Mr. Maloney, and that was there a theory of honest services fraud here that didn't require the jury to conclude in the first instance that Mr. Biriano had deprived his clients of their money? And the answer is there wasn't.
Well, he says there is. Maybe you can address the arguments that he made. He says there are all these other things, these violations of the election laws and so on, which gave him a basis for finding an honest services violation and not pecuniary fraud.
The connection between the victims in this case, which are these clients,
right,
and what they articulate are the honest services deprivations, is the money. In other words, giving money to candidates, if it was Mr. Biriano's money, wouldn't harm these clients except for the fact that it was their money, unbeknownst to them, of course, without their consent,
so
without their authorization.
Was all about the $600?
Absolutely, Judge King. I wasn't one of the trial attorneys either. I was a junior in high school when the case was tried.
But as I always say, it's your case now.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
We can have.
I did talk with the trial attorney. The argument that this evidence was all about honest services is a mischaracterization. All of this evidence goes to the pecuniary fraud, and a case just on pecuniary fraud would look exactly the same.
Well, I'm not sure that's a fair characterization. It seems to me that the harder argument for the government to make here was the honest services case. And therefore, often, as what happens, they spent an undue amount of time on that. The easier case, the less sexy case, if you will, was the $600 in pecuniary fraud.
If we look at what they...
unless you're right that you couldn't have had the honest services convictions without the pecuniary fraud, I'm not sure you can prevail.
Your Honor, if we look at what they claim is the quote-unquote honest service evidence, it's testimony about campaign contribution limits, reporting requirements, and then testimony from these candidates who got contributions, conduit contributions, through his employees. That evidence would have to be presented to a jury in order for them to understand the theft scheme. This court, in affirming the conviction, described the theft scheme as having three parts. Mr. Biriano asked employees and family members to make contributions. He reimbursed them with firm funds, and then he spread the cost of those reimbursements out across his clients. If the jury didn't know that there were these limits. It wouldn't make any sense why he used employees to make conduit contributions. It was motive evidence. Same thing with these candidates that testified. Even though the checks came from employees of his firm, every candidate testified they knew Mr. Barriano was behind these contributions, either because the employee wrote in the memo line, Bruce Barriano asked me to send this, or there was a cover letter that indicated that, or there was an envelope from the law firm, or Mr. Barriano himself told them. So in order to make sense of what both the defense and the prosecution described as a theft scheme, the campaign contribution limits had to be explained, and it had to be explained to the jury that the motive to do this was to curry favor with these politicians, but using other people's money. I mean, that's what makes this what this court has called a classic mail fraud scheme. The appellant was greedy. He didn't want to pay for these conduit contributions, so he put it off on the backs of his clients. And from the start of this trial to the finish, that was the issue.
So the victims were the clients?
Yes, sir.
Who said they didn't consider themselves victims?
And on that, you know, the appellant makes this interesting argument that on the basis of that testimony, the jury could have convicted the defendant of honest services fraud, but not pecuniary fraud. If you look at what the victims here actually said, is they said they didn't believe they were victims, that in the course of their reviewing their bills, they didn't detect fraud, but they also said they were very happy with him as a lobbyist.
Right, so it didn't matter to them if he did do this.
Exactly, and if the jury had put weight on that testimony, they would have acquitted him both of honest services fraud and pecuniary fraud, because that was really what these clients testified about. They liked the lobbying work he did. They even stayed with him, some of them, after the indictment. The other thing they point to are the comments of the trial judge in this argument that the evidence was weak. And Judge Nickerson, obviously, in the lower court in this quorum nobis proceeding, said his comments are irrelevant. And just
he was
to the,
both the trial judge in the trial and the quorum nobis.
Yes,
trial judge.
And in the quorum nobis proceeding, he concluded that the evidence on pecuniary fraud was overwhelming. He both said his comments were irrelevant and, applying harmless error analysis, that the evidence before the jury at that time was overwhelming.
Okay, and let me just probe your argument a little bit about this honest services claim was necessarily always a claim for pecuniary services. There wouldn't have been any deprivation of honest services if there hadn't been pecuniary fraud. Hypothesize for me a situation, if you can, use
sure.
just elaborating from these facts in this case, where you'd have something that would be an honest services claim and not pecuniary fraud. In other words, does your argument go too far
sure.
is what I'm trying to get at.
No, Your Honor. In Black, in the remand in Black, the Seventh Circuit reversed two convictions, finding the error was not harmless, and affirmed one. Those convictions, the counts that they reversed on, present, I think, the answer to your question. And if I may, just for a moment, the facts there were...
I would rather if you could use the facts of these cases or just
sure.
add to the facts of the case we have in front of us.
If Barriano had reduced legitimate expenses that were owed to him, let's say for really taking legislators out to dinner or to ball games, if he had reduced them, legitimate expenses that were owed to him, and then padded the bills with these illegal campaign contributions. And at the end of the day, on a net basis, the clients weren't out any money, and the only thing they were out was the information that he had done this to them. That would be an honest services theory that didn't ride on the back of a theft theory. I mentioned Black because that's precisely the case for the counts in Black that were reversed. In those counts, Black and the other defendants recharacterized some fees that Hollinger owed them to get favorable tax treatment in Canada. And what the court said was Hollinger owed them that money anyway, so the only thing they deprived them was knowing what it was actually for. The count that was affirmed in Black was a count related to some non-compete agreements, and I think that most closely resembles the facts here. What the court said there was Black and his co-defendants were paid certain money as part of a sale. They claimed it was for non-compete agreements. The non-compete agreements didn't exist, but their defense was it was an innocent mistake. We didn't draft them. And what the Seventh Circuit said was either the jury believed that was an innocent mistake and they would have acquitted on money and property and honest services, or they didn't believe it was an honest mistake and they therefore convicted on both. That's what we have here. There's no claim that Barriano was owed this money anyway. that he simply did this to hide it or to further the concealment in his law firm's books and records. This was money he was not owed.
You're right. I don't think that they make that claim. I thought that they were making, at least in the argument here this morning, the claim that the honest services were somehow separate and apart from any monetary payment.
Right.
The honest services claim. And they, as I said, they talked about violations of the election law. And is it your position that there would have been no violation of law without the monetary payments?
I think there would have been no violation.
You can certainly violate the election laws.
Right. I think there would have been no violation of federal law if he hadn't billed the clients for these.
All state law problems.
Would have been state law problems, yes, Your Honor. What made this a federal offense was, it wasn't, he didn't stop.
How did this ever get into federal court?
Again, the high school defense there.
I was in this court one day as a lawyer, and I heard the former chief judge say to a lawyer from the Maryland or the Virginia Attorney General's office, when he said he didn't know, he wasn't counsel below, he said, "You go back and find out, and come back after lunch and tell us."
Got it. Well, I did actually.
I'm not going to say that to you, but
Dale Kelberman, who was the prosecutor, I did actually meet with him.
He's retired.
He's retired. He is retired.
That's the practice of law.
there is no jurisdictional limit. I mean, I sort of made a joke of it, but the wire fraud statute doesn't have a floor. Whether it's $600 or $6 million or $6. The elements do not require loss. And the appellant points to that as if that were some instructional error, but we don't ever instruct on loss.
So we go back to, you think that all the other violations of law that he says are separate and apart and could have been honest services violations are violations of state law, not federal law. Any federal law violation had to be tied to the cash.
Yes, ma'am. But understanding those state law violations, again, is motive evidence for understanding why he was passing these costs on to his client, concealing.
If the indictment hadn't included the or in the alternative honest services point, or alternative element, is it your proposition that all the evidence that was admitted would yet have been admitted?
Yes, Your Honor. It would need to have been presented. And if you look at the indictment, Judge Motz, you started with looking at the indictment.
Right.
What does the indictment charge? It charges false bills and the checks paying them. It doesn't allege that disclosure reports were incorrect. It doesn't allege that he withheld information from the client. The case starts and ends with false bills, two clients, and the checks those clients paid pay those bills. Now, looking to another...
Did Judge Nickerson agree with you on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Give any deference to his view?
As he himself said, his comments outside the presence of the jury, he used the word, were irrelevant.
About in ruling on this case.
No, Your Honor. I think it's...
You don't think we give any deference to what...
I think it's
the Judge Nickerson, notwithstanding the fact that he was a trial judge.
I think because it's de novo review, I think it's illuminating his views, but I think there's no deference afforded.
But they've been up there arguing at the trial. This doesn't have anything to do with the pecuniary fraud. It all has to do with honest services, and they didn't charge that. You'd have had to argue it's 404B or something, wouldn't you?
I think it is essential to the pecuniary fraud scheme to understand what those limits were. If not for the limits, the jury would have said, well, why is he using these employees, right? If not for the limits, he could have made the contributions himself, reimbursed himself with law firm funds, and then taken the money from his clients to cover the reimbursements. They had to understand what these limits were. Similarly, all these candidates testified about the fact that they knew it was him. And that's really crucial to understanding his motive for engaging in the theft scheme. He needed these weren't anonymous contributions going to these politicians. He needed these politicians to understand he was behind them. Even though the check itself may have been from his bookkeeper, he made sure in every instance, and every single one of these politicians testified to this, that they knew he was connected with that contribution and they credited him for it. Now, Judge Motz, looking particularly at this court described a three-part scheme. The government, that really was a theft scheme, the government argued there were three deprivations of honest services as a result of the execution of that scheme. And each of them have a theft at its heart. They were, and this is argued in the government's closing, that he used his client's money to make illegal campaign contributions. That's what they said was the first way he deprived them of honest services. He used their money to make campaign contributions. Second, he caused clients to go over campaign contribution limits by using their money to make secret conduit contributions. Again, money's at the heart of it. And then third, that he gave client money without their consent to candidates who took positions at odds with those clients' interests. Again, you don't get to any of those deprivations of honest services if you don't conclude in the first instance that he was using their money and took their money without their consent and their authorization. And while they all testified they didn't believe he was a bad lobbyist and they didn't feel defrauded by him, they all testified that he was not authorized to bill them for legislative entertainment that was really campaign conduit campaign contributions. And every client was clear on that.
So I understand your argument. So notwithstanding the fact that we have a general verdict, it's that logical connection between the money and the subsequent acts that makes it clear that the jury could only have found the defendant guilty, wouldn't necessarily have had to find the defendant guilty of pecuniary fraud, notwithstanding any mistake that was made with respect to honest services.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. And that's the same conclusion the Seventh Circuit reached in Black and the Fifth Circuit reached in Skilling, as to the counts that were affirmed in both those cases.
Okay. I think we understand your argument.
Thank you, Your
Honor.
Unless
you have something further.
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Your Honor, the government below made a very different argument. The government a moment ago said that this
information in the trial,
in the trial,
just proceeding
in the trial. Thank you. Below, the government described parts one and two as their honest services case. They asked and received instruction that said you could find based upon honest services or pecuniary fraud, not and pecuniary fraud. The evidence that was just described to you as motive evidence, the government introduced in its case in chief as honest services evidence. This was hotly contested evidence, and the government asked that it be introduced under the honest services theory. It was admitted under the honest services.
Our alternative theories. Your was proper, wasn't it, to you?
At that time, at the state of the law at that time, it was.
It was proper.
There were alternative theories.
And Skilling said that one of them is an invalid theory.
Exactly.
And the question, that's right. That's what brings us here. But there wasn't anything wrong with, at that stage, using the or instead of the and.
Or was entirely appropriate at that time, given the state of the law. But as a result of the or, it makes it impossible to conclude today, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the honest services instruction, argument, and testimony did not, beyond a reasonable doubt, contribute to the guilty verdict.
Do you disagree that the evidence would have come in anyway, even if the government had simply proceeded on pecuniary fraud?
I strongly disagree. Of the 1,700 pages of testimony, I would argue that only 168 of those pages, as we've set forth in our brief, really relate to pecuniary fraud.
That's pretty precise.
It is, and we provided a table, actually, in our brief of what we believe to be the honest services, which took up 80% of the trial, and then the pecuniary fraud, which took up the balance. The testimony, what you just heard about the candidates testifying in this particular case, for instance, we had Chris Van Hollen, who said, as a result of receiving this contribution from the Saltwater Sports Fishermen's Association, I didn't know who it was from. It caused us to make false reports. These are why we have election laws. Well, that really had nothing to do with how Mr. Biriano obtained the funds by reimbursement, the $150 here, at all. And it wasn't in any way necessary to prove that Mr. Biriano had gotten the $150. It was basically explosive, as the court, to use a word by the panel, sexy testimony of public officials coming in and saying, by getting this contribution in someone else's name, we filed a report that was incorrect, we filed a report that was false. And the government itself, in closing argument, characterized all that evidence as honest services evidence. When describing what Mr. Van Hollen did at page JA1833, describing his testimony, said, is that honest and faithful services? Describing the testimony involving Phillips Publishing and how they had gone over the limit, is that honest and faithful services? Describing the testimony of Diane Kirchenbauer, who was a candidate for the legislature in the 20th District, is that honest and faithful services? And that refrain rang throughout the closing argument as well as through the rest of the case, that Mr. Biriano was a fiduciary, That word was used by the government, and it was also used in jury instructions, that he had a duty not to conceal these campaign contributions from his clients, and that by concealing that information about the contributions being made and the limits being made, that he had violated his fiduciary duty to tell his clients that these contributions had been made and they might have been antithetical for his interests. Those stand separate and apart from the issue as to how he might have obtained the money. The government at that time repeatedly referred to this as honest services, faithful services. In fact, they broke down the word faithful and used the word fidu, the Latin route of it, that he was the fiduciary for these individuals. The government today, post-Skilling, would not be allowed to argue any of those things. The test here, what really happened is the government put on, in its 1,700-some pages of honest services, very sexy, classic political corruption type evidence to show that, quote, Mr. Bariano had corrupted the political system with the $150 that he obtained. The $150 that he had obtained from the clients was relatively incidental to most of what was talked about there from a factual standpoint, from a jury appearance standpoint. These were high-impact witnesses for the jury. This jury was being told that the political system had been corrupted by Mr. Bariano. This is really, I asked the panel to look at the impact of those 1,700 pages on the jury and not the legal sufficiency. This is a jury impact issue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will come down and greet the lawyers and then go directly to our second case.
Thank you.